This week on Decentralized, the Pirate Bay seized again.
The Russian ruble collapses.
Then we talk to Isaac Morehouse, founder and CEO of Praxis.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralized.
How's it going, everybody? This is Tony here on Decentralized, and we have some awesome topics today, and I'm going to throw it to Eric, who is going to introduce the first topic he wants to talk about, because Eric is the man. What's up?
What's up, man? So I think the first topic we're talking about is the Russian ruble collapse, or is it the Pirate Bay? What should we talk about
first? Let's talk about the ruble.
I'm really, really crazed about this one, because Russia has undergone a massive revolution, right? And I think it stands out as an example of sort of change in a national government, and you know, they transition from communism into this sort of oligarchy that they've developed in their government structure. And I find it really fascinating to see, like, along with the oil prices sort of plummeting over the past like month or two, going down from like $100 a barrel down to $55-$60 a barrel now. The ruble has actually sort of tracked with that, and just yesterday they completely halted trading, which I found completely fascinating. In that there's a number of banks now refusing to accept rubles, refusing to do ruble withdrawals, all of these things. And it's sort of the second time that Russia has undergone this major sort of economic upheaval. And the fact that it's tracking prices with oil really fascinates me. As we know, Russia and China have really worked together in the past with the oil prices and the currency swap deal that they did earlier this year. I just find it really interesting. We're living in amazing economic times.
We are. And it's something with fiat currencies as well. It makes you wonder, well, it makes me wonder, as someone who's relatively new to the game of studying anything economic, What exactly is the role of oil in our economy, in the global economy, you know? And what would happen if let's just say we woke up tomorrow and there was a new energy source that wasn't oil, that was completely renewable, that required little to no work for anything? What would our economy really be based on in the world, you know? And this is, again, these are very, I would say, naive, open-ended questions for a reason, because I'm a big fan of saying that no one really knows how economics works. We all have like theories, and that's why they're always, you know, this school, this school, this school. I don't think anyone's figured it out. I think some are closer than others, and I think with awesome things like, you know, our favorite topic, Bitcoin, we're actually going to have real life data of how an economy works. And to me, that's one of the little values that no one ever mentions, is how we now have, you know, recorded data of every transaction in an economy. Very, very new thing that we're going to be able to study, and you know, it's interesting. It is a very interesting time.
So what's really crazy is like, okay, so we got rid of the gold standard in 1972,
yes.
Right? Where the U.S. dollar used to be.
I thought it was 71.
71, 72. I'm not entirely sure.
I can find out. Continue.
So we got rid of the gold standard, and we truly entered into the fiat era. Where the U.S. dollar became a fiat currency in that it was only backed by the trust and faith that you have in the issuing government or issuing corporation in the U.S. dollar's case. So as, you know, sort of there was like an oil crisis and, you know, times have grown and the U.S. economy has expanded and sort of shrunk a little bit. Rather than having a U.S. dollar that's effectively pegged to gold and as an underlying backing value system, we've removed gold. And a lot of people say that the U.S. dollar is baseless. It doesn't have like a backing other than trust. But what has emerged in its place, whether the government or the Fed actually intended this, is a oil-backed dollar. And if you look at what's happening, the oil-backed dollar is actually being used. Like, that's how oil trade is being done. The second or third largest company in the world by market cap, obviously, kind of fluctuates, and it has changed recently due to the decreasing oil prices. It is an oil company. Oil is one of the most heavily traded commodities in the world, and it's traded in dollars, and that is the base that effectively pegs the value of a dollar to the perceived value of oil as well. So we've replaced a system with a gold backing with a consumable good, which is fundamentally an unstable good. As you talk about, like, us discovering other technologies, the value of oil, because the demand is going to decrease over time, right? Because we're having new ways of producing energy. If the value of the dollar is pegged, or any currency, the ruble, for example, is pegged to this underlying consumable asset that becomes less in demand, what happens to that pegged asset? Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it gets dragged down in the value along with it. And I think the ruble, Russia being a major controller of oil in the Eurasian markets, right, as oil has sort of come down, it's bringing the ruble with it. And I'm curious, because the dollar has, due to quantitative easing and all of these, you know, interesting things that are happening around the world, the dollar has been somewhat resilient, frankly, over the past couple years, which surprises me, frankly. But I'm wondering what happens once, you know, we had the Cyprus collapse, and we had the Grecian issue. We have these European debt issues. We have the ECB with negative interest rates, and now the ruble collapse. What is going on? Japan is rapidly approaching default. Like, what is going on, and how is this going to impact this last bastion of the fiat era that we have?
Also, I just wanted to fill in this. It was actually 1971, August 15th, 1971. And if you think about it, that's almost 44 years that we've been in an era without a gold standard. And do you know when I end up in the obligatory Bitcoin conversation with people, and they always say, well, the U.S. dollar is backed by gold, and it's like, that's a long time. That's old, you know, 44 years. 44 years next year, I should say. So 43. That's like, wow. How out of date is that news? Like, why are people my age and younger still under this assumption that it's backed by anything other than guns?
Because the education system sucks. I mean, it's been a half
amen.
A century.
And that's something we're going to talk about later with our guests. So we're going to shoot this over to you, James, as you definitely had something you wanted to say.
Oh, yeah, it's certainly interesting to see all these phenomena unfolding, especially with currencies. And actually, you know, to actually add to that, it's been even longer for U.S. citizens for the gold backing to be lost. Actually, in 1933, for U.S. citizens,
wasn't it made illegal?
Exchange rate. Yeah, well, it was made illegal and confiscated. And a lot of people theorize, obviously, that Satoshi's symbolic birthday falls in the date on which, you know, that executive order was issued. But for U.S. citizens, it was 1933. For international exchange, it was 71. So seeing kind of how that's changed and how that free-floating currencies have acted has been kind of a puzzler. And so, you know, kind of these theories about, you know, whether it's tied to oil or what drives these prices is really quite a lesson what you were saying earlier, that, you know, there is a knowledge problem for everyone trying to analyze what causes these price swings up and down in any commodity or even Bitcoin. So kind of that's probably really the most damning indictment against central banking is the fact that, you know, really no one has knowledge of a full economy. It's the individual actors.
Yet,
which makes
me smile when I say yet, because it's going to be awesome to be able to have this data.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be awesome to have this data. But obviously, even with Bitcoin, it's hard to track, you know, the overall mm-hmm. movement of the economy. But that is a hopeful sign that it's going down from the level of, you know, central planners to individual actors.
Absolutely. And with that being said, in the news recently, there's been a lot of, 2014's worst investment, Bitcoin. And it, as Eric just chuckled, I chuckle too, because usually when I read that, I don't even need to read the article, which I will, but I can just immediately assume what they're going to say. And I'm sitting there reading it going, this person just views everything as an investment that's reading this. And if you're viewing Bitcoin as an investment, fine, that's cool. But man, it's so much more than that, and it really is changing things, and it's really positive. If you'll notice, there's a hum that's dying, and I think that's because, you know, the government heard us talking about Bitcoin and got sad. No, the government had nothing to do with that. But what it does, I think, what is important here is realizing that as much negativity as you'll see about Bitcoin as an investment, there's very good things happening to the technology, as in the number of wallets that are being used keeps rising. The number of transactions keep rising. The important metrics that aren't that value that, you know, every person who seems to be interested in Bitcoin cares so much about, they're all up. And, you know, I'm very bullish when it comes to 2015 as when it comes to adoption of the technology?
Yeah, look, any sort of asset class or even a monetary currency is going to be treated as a speculative investment by somebody somewhere, especially early on, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the best opportunity to get into any sort of asset is very early. So we're coming to a close, I think, of the fifth year of Bitcoin at this point, which is now we're a half decade old. It's still very much in its infancy.
Kindergarten era.
Not even kindergarten, I would say. I used to say when I would go out and talk, I would say, you know, Bitcoin is not even in its infancy yet. It's actually still in the womb. It's yet to be birthed, right? And I think now we're sort of entering into the infancy, right, where, okay, so now we have a little bit of price stability, right, since the peak, right, of last year. It went up to $1,200, and now it's back down to, you know, $320. Okay, so that's the peak, but it's still up, you know, mm-hmm. 200% over like a year and a half period. It's still up, 1,000% over, 2 year period, right? Like zoom out a little bit and understand the perspective mm-hmm. of what's happening here. Now, we as Bitcoiners, we like to talk about the utility of Bitcoin and blockchain technology. One of the things we do have to remember is, we have to temper our own, enthusiasm for Bitcoin. And rather than just sort of discarding, this thing that, the price went up to 1,300 and, it's down, 40% year over year. That's the worst investment. Well, number one, no, it's not the worst investment. Number two, yeah, that kind of does sting a little bit, right? It does, in fact, sting for a lot of the people who totally have bought into Bitcoin, especially because of that bubble. And a lot of people got in and a lot of people have lost a lot of their stored value. So you have to realize that is the reality of things. But the utility of the blockchain still remains, right?
Of course.
Right? And the other side of the argument is, the price doesn't matter.
Nope.
It doesn't when you're talking about it from a transactional medium. If you're pricing in one currency and you use Bitcoin solely for the transactional cost, you acquire the Bitcoin at that cost, you transmit it at that cost, and then you exchange it back at that cost, right? It becomes the most efficient method of transmitting value in history, right? Across the globe. It's just simply there is no better system. Smart contracts. We're starting to see the massive growth of the smart contract ecosystem with counterparty success this year. Ethereum is continuing to get grown attention. Storage is another common topic. All of these different uses that just simply were not possible 3-4 years ago before this problem was solved. That is the outlook for Bitcoin. That is the outlook for this decentralized economy right now. These people who are trying to treat it like the traditional, banking infrastructure, like, oh, yeah, we're gonna buy a stock and it's gonna go up or down. Like, stop. You're right. People did lose value on that, and that's not what it is, right? Yep. But that's besides the point. The fact of the matter is that this train is gonna keep on going, right? There's a bunch of people who've gotten on board. There's people who've, kind of fallen off to the wayside, and there's also people who are clamoring their way up to the front of the engine mm-hmm. and trying to build more things to take advantage of this train that's accelerating as we're moving into the future. And I'm really excited to see some of the products that I know. I've talked to a lot of people that they're really working hard on trying to fight through some of these regulations from the governments to get these products to market, because that is, frankly, one of the last remaining hurdles right now is these regulatory hurdles. There's mm-hmm. a lot of innovators out there who are trying to build really cool things that are really powerful, but the legal frameworks, the governments, simply by very nature of inefficiency, are incapable of designing laws that make these things possible within a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, and I'm going to have a little fun here, because this is what I love doing is prognosticating. So let's do the official 2015 prognostication of awards, I guess. We'll come up with something like that, and we'll see next year if we're right. What do you think? I'm going to go with you, James, first. What do you think will happen with Bitcoin and in general decentralized technology? But let's focus on Bitcoin this week, because maybe we can talk about more decentralized technologies next week. What do you think is going to be the big news that comes out of this year?
Well, I'm here to announce that I'm fairly certain that one Bitcoin will equal about 40,000 ruble by this time next year. So if that encourages anyone out there about the Bitcoin price, just think of it in different terms. So I think really the most important thing is that Bitcoin will continue to grow in its uses and its applications in the real world for creating value. I suppose, I mean, oftentimes when people do look at the price, they are considering the fact that, you know, yes, we do anticipate that Bitcoin as a deflationary currency will gain in value, and that can have a lot of benefit for a lot of people. But they're missing when they look only at the price and as a metric of value, they're missing the value that's being created by its applications, by its, you know, easing of international commerce, by its, you know, liberating of personal finance. These things are creating value which we can't see and we can't measure by just looking at a stock ticker on Google or an app. So this is sort of the great French economist Frédéric Bastiat wrote the essay, What is Seen and What is Not Seen. We can see the Bitcoin price and we, you know, create our impressions from there, but if we look at what is being created and imagine, you know, the cost that they're being saved and what's created with those funds, that's a truly exciting thing. So I think in 2015, we're going to see, or we're going maybe not see actually, but it's going to be happening.
It's happening, exactly.
A huge development of Bitcoin and making it more useful for a lot of people.
Eric?
Yeah, so I think we're starting to see what's going to happen in 2015 over the past month with this ruble collapse. If you go look at some of these exchanges that offer, you know, various types of, you know, foreign exchange, like ruble for Bitcoin, the volume of people trying to get rid of their ruble in favor of Bitcoin has skyrocketed over the past like couple days, right? It's mm-hmm. It's massive. In perspective, it's still low in volume in comparison to the overall markets. So what I think is going to happen is we're going to see the rollout of a number of real smart contract-based Bitcoin/2.0 blockchain-based technologies that are going to make it to market and are going to gain a lot more attention. The press this year has largely been focused on Bitcoin itself. What is Bitcoin, right? The people who are watched still happen to be watching, you know, television these days. You know, I think they've kind of heard Bitcoin by
yes.
now, right? Some of them may have been like, oh, cool, this is a great idea, and they may have invested. But that's going to completely go away in 2015, and I think we're going to start seeing a transition towards these smart contracts, and we'll see at least one or two major successes in that space.
I agree to that to some degree, so I'm going to kind of view my prognostications in a different format. I think it's going to be the year that the AOL of Bitcoin will emerge. And by that, I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in a way where the average American that maybe isn't the most tech savvy, that has some tech skills, you know, is able to get it, they're going to be introduced to Bitcoin in new ways. The infrastructure is going to grow. More and more merchants are going to accept it. I think we're going to see, Microsoft, I think, was the first, and we're going to see a few more, maybe one or two really big companies of the same size as a Google, Amazon, Apple, you know, that size. I'm not saying them specifically, but they're going to jump on board. I think you're going to see an improvement in wallet design. You're going to see an improvement in wallet security. I think you're going to see just an overall enhanced infrastructure that's going to be ready for the next wave of adopters to come on board. It's happened so far every year to that degree, so I don't see why it wouldn't take that jump this year. I also think you're going to see, as it's already started, it's going to infiltrate gaming more. And I think once you infiltrate gaming more, you're going to see that demographic of young males that are going to be influencers, and they're going to spread it, and they're going to move to the next steps of businesses. The people that are buying their clothes online, or they're maybe going to Urban Outfitters, you're going to see places like that are a little more hipstery take it. I think it's going to have an increased mainstream view of hipness. Like, it's going to be cool. You're going to see more references by artists in music and movies and television. You're going to see more references on TV. It was on Jeopardy last night. And it was, you know, of course, it was about Magic the Gathering and Mt. Gox, but still, it was on Jeopardy last night. And you're going to see that happening a lot more. It's going to be interesting how it finally happens. But, you know, while we're talking about the awesomeness of Bitcoin, we need to talk about one of the services that paved the way for Bitcoin and all the drama that's surrounding it, which is the Pirate Bay. Arr! I love the Pirate Bay. I love everything they stand for. They give me the goosebumps because they get it, and they force the music industry to adapt. And I think the music industry, as far as artists themselves, are very, very, very stronger because of it. And I think actually the music industry is stronger because of it. And what you're seeing is now with one of the, I believe it was with this North Korea hack, that happened the past week with Sony. One of the docs that were, maybe it was a part of this hack, don't quote me on this, was talking about how Google got frustrated with the MPAA because Google has been taking down all of these pirate sites, not just the Pirate Bay, but any kind of torrent site. They've been kind of really aggressively going after this on behalf of the MPAA and RIAA. And because of it, what we're doing is basically Google shut these down, and the MPAA were not happy with it. They were saying they didn't do enough. So Google was kind of like, really? Because we think we're doing a lot, so peace. We don't want to work with you anymore. And here's the thing. The MPAA and the RIAA do not represent the artists. They do not represent actors. They do not represent musicians, songwriters, script writers. They represent none of those. They represent the big business behind it. And it's very important for people to realize, and especially the artists, and I mean that in, across the board, they understand these companies are not working on their behalf. They've been screwing over artists for decades. And when they kind of wake up and say, hey, what happened with things like Pirate Bay and Napster and all of this is we actually have more control now because we control the distribution channels. And they're empowered to do this, and they're empowered to be able to communicate with their audience or potential audience immediately. It should signify a real change. And I think as younger artists are, you know, coming into the mainstream now and all of these formats, you're seeing that mind shift change. And it's really good because it's going to be fantastic in a year, in 10 years, when art is going to be completely democratized and just completely changed. And I'm so happy for that to happen because turn on the radio and listen to the crap. Listen, yeah. It's bad, and it's so unoriginal, and that's not – and so, this is fixing that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't just the Pirate Bay, and I think, you know, one of the original founders, Peter Sund, you know, talked about this really well. Pirate Bay is sort of – I think it's been, what, 10 years since they've been around, and they've really changed hands a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the founders have been – are either on trial or in jail – for what they've done, but the Pirate Bay continues on, right? Which is which talks about that spirit. They also had this section on their website, the legal section,
where which was the best.
Anyone who tried to, assert United States law or another country's law over the Pirate Bay and say you guys are violating these United States laws, they would post those responses and say like, your laws don't apply to us. We are not in the United States. We're sorry, but. We do not have to comply by your laws. And they're right. They're absolutely correct. You know, jurisdiction is a funny thing. But the Pirate Bay wasn't the start of all of this, right?
No.
Now, it has, in fact, I've seen a lot of really good articles lately, partly because of the Pirate Bay, but also because it's sort of on, you know, the public consciousness's mind at this point. But the culture of free, right? And how, like, some of these modern news outlets are starting to understand and really give some good journalism about it. But others still just don't get it, and they're grasping at straws at trying to figure out, you know, how can we survive in this era where a majority of the population now expects things to be available for free. This transition to streaming services, partly as a result of BitTorrent, but BitTorrent's – the road was paved to BitTorrent from, you know, LimeWire and Napster before it, right? So this culture of free again, this is basic economics. I don't think it's a problem. And the reason for that is when you have a finite asset, right, that it requires effort to produce and there's a limited amount of just by the very nature of it being a physical thing, right, whether it be a good or a service, right, the demand for that good or service is what impacts its value, its price, right, its fair value. When you have a digital good, what you have is an infinite supply, an infinitely copyable resource, such as an MP3 file. As much hard drive space as I have, as many people as I know, I can copy that file with zero loss to anybody, right? There is no damage being done. There's no quality loss being done. There's none of this. It is infinitely copyable, which means that you can, in your supply and demand equation, you can say that there's an infinite supply and there's a finite demand, right? So I think while we're going through this transitionary period into this questionable future model, right, there is going to be a lot of this churn, right? And this sort of like last breath, dying gasp that the MPAA and RIAA are doing and shutting down the Pirate Bay yet again. And I'm sure it'll be back. And in fact, I think there's already like two or three clones that have sprung up. In this dying breath, there's going to be a lot of this churn. But as these older models die out, we're going to start seeing a merit-based society like you're talking about, where now that there is so much noise out there, right? Everything is free. You can get anything you want for free. The only way to rise above is to just simply be better.
Oh, I love it. The best quote. I was going to say, good content is what matters.
That's
like
right.
Any product.
That's
you
right.
You have a good product, maybe, and not everyone who uses it will pay, but the ones that care and want to support you will.
Yeah. Stop writing crappy pop songs.
Yep.
Start publishing good content, and you will win. You
yes.
will profit from this.
Yes.
Your shows will be sold out. People will buy your T-shirts. They'll pay to see you in person.
They'll pay
right?
for your movie.
They'll pay for your movie.
Yeah.
They will go out and do this.
Amen.
And this is very interesting as well. We are seeing the transition now that content is free, and it's really impossible to enforce, you know, costs on the content itself. We are seeing more of a service model emerging, like shows, like concerts, things like that. Sort of interesting parallel to sort of software as service. I mean, this is something that was probably very much, you know, pioneered sort of with the origin of software and with the, you know, with digital goods in general. So this is very interesting to see that change occurring. And I do agree with Tony. That when you do remove this sort of monopoly of intellectual property or of intellectual restriction, you are going to see more competition. And artists do sort of have a way of meeting that in the fact that, you know, input costs are now correspondingly lower. You know, the final good is obviously reproducible for free, but the cost of producing those goods have gone down significantly. The barriers to entry have gone down. The ways to reward artists for their content have increased exponentially as well. You know, you see ChangeShip, you see obviously these service models. So I think even in this area where there has been a lot of argument, you know, among artists about, you know, how do we become compensated in this new era of free, there are answers and there are innovations to be made. Bitcoin feeds into this. All these yeah. models do.
Yeah. I think the service model is really important here because maybe not for streaming. And streaming is sort of like a temporary holdover until we've got something truly – everyone transitions to the better way. But this model where you perform a non-reproducible service, right? Like data API or maybe something that actually has an output that cannot be reproduced. Something. We'll see these models change. But what's really interesting to me is it's almost entirely driven by, you know, your youth, like the people who are, you know, coming to this world without pre-established notions as much as they can, right? Who really made Napster a thing, right? It was largely college students who were looking for free music because they don't have a lot of money. They mm-hmm. can't pay for the artists they like, right? So they went to Napster, of course. Yeah. LimeWire, Napster, all of this stuff. BitTorrent, like it's all teenagers and college students, right? And I think that sort of segues into, you know, why it's so important for, you know, our education system to be supportive of these new ideals.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like if someone has this unique perspective, you shouldn't squash it out of them and
no.
tell them that they're thinking something the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
You should support them and allow them to develop their logic, right? And allow them to sort of, you know, just
but we don't want kids thinking for themselves. Come on.
Heaven forbid, you know, somebody comes up with, you know, a new way to do, you know, linear mechanics or something like that, right? Like,
yeah.
Heaven forbid, right?
Yeah.
But so I think that's a perfect transition for our guest who will be joining us shortly.
That is, but there is one thing I wanted to say before we bring him on, and that is it's just a different perspective, and it's something about the history of this, and I want to sum it up as quick as I can, but look at the history, at least in, you know, from the 1920s to now, since there was a recorded music industry. As everyone listening knows, I have a background in, you know, working in the music industry. So I like to tell people exactly how much better it's gotten for artists because of streaming services, by streaming, let me rephrase that, torrents, peer-to-peer services, and how much better it truly is for them. And then throughout the 1920s until about, I'd say, the 1960s, artists were usually paid a flat rate for their performance, right? Much like they would play a concert. So let's say you're signing away the rights for two songs for a 45 to Sun Records, whoever. They're going to pay you $500, and that's what you get. And you might get one copy of your record to take home so you could listen to it with your family. They get all the proceeds for that, right? There's no royalties. There's none of that, right? So somewhere around the line, you know, some of the managers and business managers of artists figured this out and said, hey, we should get royalties, right? So that became a part of it for radio play, for advertisements, for whatever they wanted. Well, somewhere, you know, along the line, people realized, hey, if I do this by myself, I'm going to make more money. So independent labels started, right? And then independent labels slowly grown until they were just the same as a regular label. Well, the industry evolved into something where, to this day, this is actually how a lot of major labels are ran, where they will get an advance. Let's say the advance is $100,000 for a band, right? This band wants to get the advantages of a label, and they do have advantages, i.e., you know, placement in store shelves, radio play, video play, all the things that a label brings you, which is they do bring a value, don't get me wrong. So they give you that. But what happens is the band now owes $100,000, right? Because that was the advance. They also owe production costs. Most bands, and by most, I mean probably 98 to 99% bands, end up completely in debt by the end of their first record. If you're the rare exception, say a Linkin Park, where their first record was a huge hit, I think Linkin Park about broke even, and that first record went, what, like 10 times platinum? Think about that for a minute. Think about how much money is spent on all these channels and greasing the palms of the same rich people that have had it for years and years and years, and how artist development no longer exists. There isn't the chance to gamble on a Led Zeppelin whose first record may not go platinum, but they may end up being one of the biggest bands of all time. That doesn't happen anymore. And the reason is because there was no competing way to get that music out there. And guess what happened over the past 10 to 20 years? There's now a new way to get that music out there. People like Whitey Cracker, people like Grammatic, people like Trent Reznor, who was a large artist and carried over, are now able to directly get their music to the audience, and that is essential.
What's amazing is pretty much the entire electronic music scene right now is exclusively people who are at home putting together their hobbyist materials and trying their best to get to use YouTube, SoundCloud, all of these tools to gain and foster fans. And this is how almost all of the top artists today have become the top artists.
And notice the Grammys don't pay them attention. MTV does not pay them attention because they're existing outside of that system.
They exist outside of the system.
It makes me like them more. I don't know about you.
And the funny thing is they're driving the entire culture right now. Mm-hmm. And MTV and all these old legacy services are just being left in the dust.
Absolutely. It's beautiful, I think.
These are the entrepreneurs of music. I mean, we're seeing entrepreneurship emerge as a force for independent artists, and we're seeing that emerge in so many areas of decentralization. That's where we think, you know, this next interview is going to be really interesting insight on what the trends for entrepreneurship are, and especially among the youth and among in education. So we're going to move on to talking to Isaac Morehouse.
We'd like to welcome Isaac Morehouse, the founder and CEO of Praxis. Isaac, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on, guys.
No problem. Thank you for being our guest. The first thing we wanted to ask, we wanted to let our audience know, is what exactly is Praxis?
So Praxis is really a new model for education. It's a 10-month program where young people, we place them with a business. So they're working in a business environment, typically smaller companies, growing companies. So they're really seeing what it's like to start a company. They're working there during the 10 months. And at the same time, they're doing a rigorous interdisciplinary curriculum online with some interactive discussion groups, oral exams. They have some workshops and projects. They build a website, kind of a whole host of things from soft skills to hard skills, all packaged in to 10 months. And the idea is really asking the question, what is needed for someone, especially if they kind of want to take their career into their own hands? What is needed to get them from where they are now, which in most cases is a student of some kind, to where they want to be? And when you ask the question, what's needed, you get a lot of things like confidence, experience, and network, some specific skills, the ability to sort of think abstractly. And all those things can be often gotten in ways better in ways outside of the traditional higher education model. Whether or not you sort of utilize college in your pursuit of a fulfilling, meaningful career, it certainly doesn't deliver everything you need. And I think there are a lot of ways to get those things better, faster, more effectively. And so we've tried to put together this package to do that. And if I could sum it up, I'd like to say my goal, my mission in life and with Praxis is to help people really come alive. And I don't think kind of following prescribed paths is usually the best way to do that.
That's fantastic. I completely agree. And, you know, we wanted to go a little forward with what you just said and see what are some issues that you see in the current attitudes toward higher education, the traditional four-year plan that most, you know, young people go through.
Yeah, it's interesting. So since I launched Praxis, and I have a lot of friends who are professors and things, I've had a lot of people continue to try to pigeonhole it or place me as, oh, well, you're anti-college, right? So you're either pro or anti-college. And I find that whole dichotomy, that it's actually very revealing of the problematic mindset that I think we've developed regarding higher education. Can you imagine if you met some young person and you said to them, well, are you pro or anti pickup truck? And they would be like, what? The question doesn't even mean anything, right? Or, you know, what's your position on whether young people need to buy a pickup truck? You know, and you got one camp that's like, it's a good investment. It's worth it. It pays itself off in the end, all these other reasons. It's a wonderful experience. Don't worry about the money. And another camp says, no, it's not worth it. You should, you know, the whole question is absurd because it's grouping every individual into some aggregate and trying to assume that you can decide whether something, whether a product, really a tool, is good for an aggregate group, which is just absurd, right? And it also assumes a lot of things about cause and effect. And all the arguments trotted out either for or against college tend to be, well, look, people with a degree have X, Y, and Z. People without it have, you know, the other things. Assumes causality. And oftentimes that's not really the case. So my thing is, I think the main problem we have is viewing higher education as like one lump unified good, and it's either good or bad for everyone. And I always tell people, look, boil it down to the individual level. What do you want in life? What are the things you believe will help you get closer to it? And if college offers the most of those things for the best deal, right? If it's one of the ways to get them and it's the one that you think has the highest benefit and the lowest cost, then go for it. It's just another tool in the toolkit. But it's not this sort of catch-all thing that, like, you're either a good person or a bad person, and that's determined by whether or not you're going to college. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So talk to us a little bit, Isaac, about, you know, what is exactly entrepreneurship, and what do you think that why do you think that the entrepreneurs are important for sort of, like, overall development?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple different ways to define entrepreneurship, and sort of, I don't know, common definition is someone who starts a business. And while I think that's definitely a very useful definition, that's part of it, I think more broadly than that, it's a type of action. So to act entrepreneurially is to innovate, to come up with new ways, sort of creative problem solving, right? Whether it's new combinations of existing goods, processes, ideas, or things that are, you know, sort of entirely new, that have never been done before, finding new ways to accomplish things, to do things. And it often comes through trial and error. You can't sort of think your way into entrepreneurship. It's really the act itself. It's innovating to solve a problem. And when you think of it that way, you realize that we all are born with entrepreneurial kind of urges, abilities. That's the dominant method that human beings learn, is by trial and error and innovation. You know, you keep trying. I mean, you see this with babies. You know, they keep trying to reach something on a high shelf. They can't get it. They push over a stool, right? They push over something wasn't intended for that use, and they stand on it. They're innovating. They're trying to sort of hack their way through. And I think it's that kind of fearless trial and error and willingness to go outside of the known method of doing things that really defines entrepreneurial action. And the reason I think it's so important, I mean, one, I think there's an element to it that's just satisfying and fulfilling. There's something very connected to who we are as humans that gets a lot of satisfaction out of doing that rather than just following pre-described procedures. But two, I think as the economy changes, all the advances in technology have really lowered transaction costs, if you want to put it in economic jargon, and made a lot of the benefits of firms and of kind of process-based production less valuable, because those existed because the transaction cost of sort of pulling in all these independent actors was very high, right? But technology reduces all of that. And so now having the individual person be able to kind of innovate and be their own sort of productive force, creative force, economically and otherwise, is more and more possible and more valuable. Machines and computers can do more and more of the rote tasks that are very simple, repeatable. Humans, the real value they add is that creativity, that entrepreneurial ability. And so the more that you awaken that in you and kind of fan that to flame, which is tends to be kind of beaten down during our education process, I think the more not only fulfilled you'll be, but valuable you'll be in terms of, you know, in the broader market economy.
I've certainly found that to be true, Isaac. And as listeners to the show know that I'm obviously a participant in the program and a big fan of Praxis. I'm curious, because we talked about how my life has changed since joining the program, about how your life has changed since founding Praxis. Can you tell us a bit about your background before Praxis and how that's changed since founding it?
Yeah. I guess it was probably 13 years ago now. I was an undergraduate. I had been homeschooled, and then I went to high school for my sophomore year. I found it very sort of stale and overly rigid. And so I went to community college for my last few years of high school, transferred into college, and graduated as quick as I can. I was 19 when I got my bachelor's, but I still felt like I wasted a bunch of time. I was working and going to college at the same time. And I was thinking, you know, here I am learning all these valuable things, working and getting paid to do it while I'm paying all this money to sit in classes, like three quarters of which at least were just not good at all. The professors didn't care. The students didn't want to be there. The whole thing was very frustrating. I had to purchase the whole bundle if I just wanted one or two elements from it. And that really irked me. There was no sort of customer focus or accountability between the service providers and the consumers, because the whole system was very sort of clumsy and cluttered. So way back then, I had this idea, and I sort of sketched out some different business plans. They were very, very laughable to look back. But I wanted some kind of educational experience that combined sort of real world work and trial and error with the best of liberal arts and abstract thinking, because I think that stuff is vital. All the best entrepreneurs I know are very philosophical people. They're asking big questions. And I didn't really know where to take it. And so for the intervening decade, I worked in primarily in and around sort of nonprofit educational institutions and very much in and around the higher education space, working with college students, high school students, et cetera. And over that time, I just found an increasing number of students unhappy and dissatisfied and feeling like they wanted more. They just didn't know what to do. And then, you know, you had the advent of massive online open courseware or MOOCs. When I was in college, you couldn't stream video on the internet, so that was out of the question. And all these technological changes. And then, you know, popular talk about maybe there's a bubble that I read, maybe there's other ways. And the time just seemed right. And so it was almost 2 years ago now, sort of the idea for Praxis came to me. And I kind of slapped together this business plan, and I asked a couple people close to me, is this crazy? What do you think? And, you know, I've shopped a lot of ideas around to some of my close friends, and, you know, they usually say, oh, that's neat. Everybody said, oh, my gosh, you have to do this. And I knew I did. And so I just pushed it and pushed it and pushed it as far as I could go, kind of doing it on the side. And it just kept going. It had legs. There was something to it that just clicked with a lot of people. This combination of kind of an apprenticeship and a really cool online curriculum combined with oral exams and things like that that just clicked. So anyway, all that to say, we officially launched a year and a half ago. Our first class just graduated. James is a part of our second class, and we're about to launch a third. And I think the thing that has surprised me the most since doing it, the way that, I don't know, maybe it's changed me, is realizing how many people want to be what I would say fully alive, but feel like they can't. They feel like they don't have a choice in life and they just have to do things that they hate. And I was really surprised by it. I thought that primarily I'd be, you know, getting a small number of people interested, but a lot of people would just say, oh, I don't want that. I want the college experience, or I want, you know, this, that, or the other thing. I'm not interested in it because I want something else. And predominantly I get people that say, that sounds awesome. I wish I could do something like that. And then we say, well, why don't you? I can't. Why not? Because of my parents, or because I've already spent 2 years and X amount of money, or because, you know, I went to college already and I got a degree, and now if I do another program, it will look bad. I have to go take a job that I hate instead, or so. And the number of people who just have sort of accepted this, I call it the conveyor belt mentality, that you just are plopped down at a certain point based on age and station in life and are moved along to the next point, and you just have to stay there, basically. That's been kind of sad, but it's also been exciting to help some people break free from that.
I agree completely, and a lot of people don't know this that listen. Before I worked in the industry here, the decentralization industry, as I will now coin the term, I helped community college students find jobs. And basically, there would be ones that would come up to me that were 18, and they would ask questions, and I always found it upon myself not to lie to them and say, well, here's the truth of the matter. You know, your resume is not going to get you a job. Your resume is a piece of paper that lists what you know. And that's it. And there's a lot of things that are going to get you a job, and a degree will not get you a job. It was kind of sad because a lot of these newer students, and it also focused a lot on, because it was in Michigan, in Detroit, it was a lot of, you know, returning students that maybe worked in an auto plant, got laid off. There was a lot of those folks too. But for the younger ones, you know, it's you need to go to college and get a good job. That's what, you know, they were told, that's what they believe, and I actually saw a lot of parents giving terrible career advice to their kids, awful career advice. Mm-hmm. And I would quite often actually say to them, you know, hey, for one thing, can we just make sure that, you know, you don't mention this to your parents, but here's what I would tell you to do. This is off the record, and I would always make that a clear point. I never discouraged them from coming to learn. I just would, you know, point it out to what the realities were in the market, what the realities were in Detroit, and something I noticed that is very similar, not really similar to what you're doing, but in an alternative kind of education way, is skilled trades. You know, those are things, yeah, that used to be taught in high school. I never had a shop class. I never had, you know, metal shop, metalworking, woodworking. Never did any of that. There were a lot of things that I felt in traditional education that they didn't cover. The fact, and I did go to a smaller school. It wasn't big at all, but it's still frustrating, and I can see that in a lot of students. So that's why I think programs like yours are important. And I also think that, you know, as people, we need to reconsider our entire point of valuing a 4-year education when so many people have it. It's not like it was 60 years ago. The access to information is different. If there's something you really want to know, you can teach yourself. There's no reason you need to go to school unless you're going to be a doctor or surgeon or something where people's lives are in your hands, or there's a certain process that you need to know. You can usually, yeah, learn it yourself. And I think that's something that, you know, there's so much money going to schools that, you know, it's just raising tuition, and people think, oh, I want that 4-year experience. Well, you can go party for 4 years and not pay that much money. I mean, you will partying, but not for the tuition. And it makes me kind of sad that, you know, there's still people that are, you know, that are going through that process thinking, when I graduate, I will get my dream job here. And no, I think kids in general, when I say kids, anyone that's younger, I wish there was more honesty saying, okay, obviously follow your dreams, but here's reality. And reality is, yeah, really important because you can't change that. Your dreams, you can always change. You cannot change reality. And really just a check of that and saying, hey, if you want to learn entrepreneurship, what better way than to go to a company that's succeeding or even failing, because you learn from failing. And it's cool what you're doing. I'm a big fan of it. And, you know, we call ourselves decentralized. This isn't a decentralized technology, but I do think down the road, education will be decentralized. It will be something where if you want to learn something, it's not going to be from one teacher. It's going to be from a group that are putting materials together that are experts in the field. I think that's going to, yeah, eventually happen, just something that's not happening right now.
Yeah, it's a la carte everything. And, you know, I think one of the main problems is the way that we look at the world in general. If we look at it as as very sort of a able to be analyzed in a very logical, structured way. The way that, you know, in biology, the way that animals are classified, you have all these sort of tiers, you know, kingdom, phylum, genus, species, etc., and they break down, everything's nice and neat. And I think when we look at the world that way, rather than what I would say it really is, sort of distributed networks, emergent orders, right? You have these things that emerge spontaneously from all these individuals seeking their own ends. But when you want to look at things in this really neat categorized way, what happens is in education and then in career, you sort of create things like subjects. Oh, well, there's, you know, history, geography, writing, math. And then you create and those feed right into career tracks or industries. Oh, you can work in marketing, finance, law, etc. And everyone kind of gets stuck in those patterns and assumes if you study the one thing that leads to this particular career, you'll just be handed a job in that career. And I don't know, I guess you're supposed to enjoy it. And reality is a lot more messy. It's a lot of what we observe in nature, or to use a technology analogy, in the internet, right? Where it's not some centrally planned hierarchy that's very nice and neat. It's this distributed network. It's this messy system where everybody's bouncing off of everybody else, and there's all these feedback loops and trial and error. And I think once you realize that, you say, I am the one who controls my own action and my own life, and the world is this kind of messy place that's very orderly, but those orders emerge and they're in flux, right? It's like the human language. There's a lot of great analogies. And once you have that realization, all these categorizations kind of break down. And it's so funny when I talk to applicants or people interested in the program, and I say, well, what are you interested in doing? What kind of work do you want to do? Marketing. Say, well, why marketing? What about it? Well, I had a marketing class that I liked once. Okay, well, what is marketing to you? I don't really know. I guess they just imagine like Don Draper or something, right? Like, they don't even know. And I say to them, marketing is not a job. It's not a category.
I work in marketing, and I agree.
Exactly. I mean, it's you could be doing marketing and be doing 1,000 different activities, and mm-hmm. It's kind of like, okay, so you like crunching numbers on spreadsheets? No, I hate that. Okay, well, that's what some types of marketing are. You like writing? No, I don't like writing. Okay, that's what other types of marketing are, right? There's it can mean a million things, and so these categories, and like those little tests, you know, high school kids take. Oh, you know, you're supposed to be whatever, a retail manager because you took this test, and it's like, what does that even mean? So I think that's been problematic. It's kind of this scientific management sort of, you know, turn everybody into a widget of a certain shape and plug them in where they belong mentality that just, it doesn't work. And it's frankly a little bit disturbing as well. So I try to tell people, don't stress so much about trying to figure out what you want to do or what job or what industry or business. All that matters, go out and try a bunch of stuff and then just, once you find out things you don't like, don't do things you dislike. That's it. That's the only rule, the only heuristic. Just don't do stuff that you don't enjoy. Everything else is fair game. And you probably won't be able to describe your job in the end or whatever you end up doing. You probably won't have a nice, neat title that makes sense. I still don't know how to describe what I do. But I just do things that I don't enjoy as much as possible.
Yeah, I that makes sense. I mean, and what you were saying just in general about how they're classified, I think that's a bit ridiculous too. And as a general question or follow-up question, what's your opinion on the I don't know what the right term is. I don't want to use something that's not right. The way that colleges control the information that are within their borders, i.e., in the Aaron Schwartz case, where all right, there's all of this all these years of research, right? And there's all these years of just gathering knowledge and writing it down so people can learn. The thing is, the college industry, the model is, you know, based on people actually paying in order to get that access, be it a journal, be it, you know, research papers. That to me is something that's a problem. It's a huge problem because it's you know, obviously privatized industry is great, but knowledge and information are the number one key to educate anything or anyone, and they're behind these gates, right? And the only way that you can get behind those gates is to pay however much money for tuition, $40,000 a year. What do you feel about that entire situation and how maybe it worked 60 years ago, but it's just not viable now?
Yeah, I think this is their constantly repeated story of all of human history. You have ideas, and they want to be free, you know, information. And a lot of people get uncomfortable by that and they want to control them. So whether it's, you know, the Star Chamber only publishing books that have the, you know, imprimatur of the church or the king, whether it's, you know, whatever it might be, you know, television networks trying to make sure that nobody can broadcast except for them, or it's universities kind of being the font of knowledge. And it doesn't always, I don't mean to be conspiratorial, it doesn't always, you know, begin as we want to control all of the information, though sometimes it does. But I think we have that. It's never sustainable in the long term, and especially now with the technology of the internet. The information out there, it's free. It's going to be free. You can't put it back in the jar. And I think this is really great. I think it challenges, you know, the many but not all of the things that universities had done, which was, hey, if you want to know, if you want to have in-depth conversations and study and get information about certain high-level things, you really have to go be in a physical place around a very small number of people who have the knowledge, or you just can't access it. And while that's an exciting environment for those who can afford it and can geographically be there, it cuts out a lot of people who may be interested. And now you don't have that anymore. Does it mean that colleges are useless or that people who charge money for the dissemination of information are somehow bad? No, I don't think so at all. I mean, I think there's always a value to helping someone understand something, to teaching, to even just curating information, right? Like I'll pay a subscription to certain online things, others I won't, right? If they do some work for me in, you know, putting together information that's more valuable than a lot of the stuff that's not very good out there, or if they help me understand it in more in-depth ways. So, I mean, there's still ways to add value and to make it worth someone's while to pay you for different things, parts of the education process. But I think the education system, the higher education system, just kind of relied on the fact that information is hard to access for a big chunk of their value creation. And now that it's not, they have to really re-examine. What is the main value that we bring to the table?
All right, Isaac. So we've got a lot of listeners out here who are either budding entrepreneurs or young people wanting to become entrepreneurs. What would be some advice that you would give to the people who are listening right now, or maybe will listen in the future, for how to carry themselves forward and to become successful?
Yeah, I think I would repeat what I had said earlier. Don't do things you don't like doing. And that doesn't mean don't ever do anything hard. It's actually quite the opposite. I use this analogy sometime. I'm not a runner, my wife is, but she wrote a marathon one time. I don't want to tell my kids that their mom had run several marathons and I didn't. So I hated the training, right? I didn't enjoy it. I would have rather been on the couch with a beer. So it was painful, and I could say it wasn't fun. I didn't like it, but I actually liked the outcome who I was going to get, which was completing the marathon more than any of the alternatives, right? So I was doing something that sort of in the short term was hard, but it was still something I liked doing. I liked knowing I could complete the marathon more than not. So I don't want it to sound like it's this kind of hedonistic message, like, you know, sit around and eat Cheetos because Isaac said that's how you become an entrepreneur. No, I mean in a much more meaningful sense. Don't do things you don't enjoy. And the number of people who are doing things that they hate day in and day out, and they really don't even have a reason. It's not, I'm suffering through this because it's going to lead me something that I know is going to be awesome at the end. It's sort of like, I'm suffering through this because, I don't know, I'm kind of expected to, and I haven't thought of anything better. Man, life's too short. You know, try a bunch of stuff, and the things that you don't like, stop doing them and move on to other things. So that would be the main one, and I'll throw in one more, and that's, get over your fear of failure. The academic system from kindergarten on, unfortunately, makes failure the biggest evil of the whole thing. It's the one thing you want to avoid at all costs. The worst thing you can do in the education system is fail or get an F. That is the most anti-exploration and anti-innovation mentality you can imagine. I've met young people who say, oh, I loved my philosophy class, but I had to drop it because it was going to bring down my GPA. It was really hard. So basically the incentive is don't do anything that's challenging you or that you might not be the best at because it will bring down your GPA. That's really a really poor way to kind of explore and get to know yourself and get to understand the world. So don't be afraid of failure. You know, if quitting a job or changing your educational path is deemed by the outside world to be failure, who cares, right? If starting a business that nobody likes or a blog that nobody reads or a podcast that nobody listens to.
Hey, people listen.
Failure,
people listen.
Who cares? I know they do. They absolutely do. So
my old one, they didn't, but this one they do.
Don't be afraid of failure. So those would be sort of my two biggest takeaways.
And Isaac, I've certainly found those to be true in the past few months. And about a few months ago, actually, you sat down to interview me, and now it seems the tables have turned. So we really want to thank you for coming on the show today. And before we go, though, we want you to plug Praxis and tell people where they can go to find out about the program, whether they're business partners interested in hosting participants like myself or actually students and young people interested in the program. Can you tell them where they can go and how they can get started?
Absolutely. Discoverpraxis.com is the website. Check it out. We've got a blog there as well. You can find us on Facebook also, Discover Praxis. And I mean, look, if you have any entrepreneurial inklings, if you're interested, whether or not you want to, you finish college or you plan to finish college, you want to take a break, a gather, or whether you want to do something different altogether, I highly recommend, checking it out. I mean, you can apply. It's free. It takes 10 minutes. It's a 10-month program, and it's going to be a pretty amazing experience. It's going to be a big challenge, but it's worth exploring, and we'd love to hear from you.
Thanks so much for your time today, and we definitely look forward to seeing where Praxis goes in the future.
Thanks, Tony, Eric, and James. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Isaac.